The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Smoke Jensen has come a long way trailing Stratton, Potter, and Richards, the bandit trio responsible for his family's brutal murder. Traveling under the alias of Buck West, he's finally found them in Barry, a town that takes up a piece of Idaho territory that's still raw, untamed frontier. Now Smoke is about to make sure that the town of Barry lives up to its name.
I'm Josh Richards. You don't much care for Deputy Rogers, do you, Mr. West?
I don't think he's got both hands in the stirrups, that's for sure.
But he does what he's told to do.
That's important to you, Mr. Richards.
Very.
You know, if the money's right, I can be as loyal as any man. More than most, I reckon.
I imagine you can. Are you looking for a job, Mr. West?
When do I start?
Oh, I know why you're here, Mr. Kirby Jensen, a.k.a. Smoke, a.k.a. Buck West. You're here to avenge your wife, your son, your father, your friend Preacher. You're so full of hate it's consuming you, eating you alive. If you let it, boy, it'll destroy you.
Potter! Stratton! Richards! This is Smoke Jensen! I'm giving you a better chance than you gave my pa, my brother, and my wife and son! 24 hours! You ready to die?
I wish I'd never heard the name, Jensen.
You'll never hear it again after today, Richards.
William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man 2. Return of the Mountain Man.
The clock is ticking on an ecological disaster.
1 minute. Let's go.
The chemicals have been rerouted to fill the silos outside the building. We need only set the charges and blow up the silos to pour the contents into the ocean and the air itself.
Time is running out, and we don't want to be here when the bombs go off.
Somebody sabotaged a tugboat and garbage scow in the Hudson only a mile or so from Manhattan. Two other similar attacks occurred at a chemical plant in Japan and an oil well off the coast of Scotland.
Somebody is deliberately attacking the environment?
That's what the president thinks.
The Stony Man teams fight a war on three fronts against terrorists who hold the environment hostage in an ambitious play for world power.
We are trying to force the hand of the entire world to do our bidding.
First, we have to make certain the world realizes they are powerless to stop us, and no place will be safe from us.
With help from Mac Bolan and American ninja John Trent, the forces of Stony Man set out to thwart a plan to put control of the Earth's resources into the hands of a consortium of power-hungry criminals.
One does not do favors without a reason. What would I get in return for assisting you?
You're not going to arrest me or accuse me in any way for the actions of the terrorists?
Not if you cooperate.
We want to buy into your organization. Let's say, 45 million Deutschmarks.
What exactly would you want for this investment?
Oh, this is driving me nuts. Who the hell are we up against?
So far, we haven't found much except the terrorists have remained several moves ahead of us.
Then we're just gonna have to catch up with them.
Better suit up for jungle combat. We're not going on a picnic, fellas.
What is it?
I could have sworn I saw... Ambush! Brace yourself. We're going down, mate.
Going down?
Rather fast.
The piers of New York, the pubs of Scotland, the boulevards of Paris, and the seamy backstreets of Osaka lead the executioner and the forces of Stony Man Farm to the rainforests of the Amazon, twisting arms and calling in favors all the way to a deadly showdown. Don't miss a world of action in Stony Man number 6.
Goodbye. It has been a pleasure.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by James Lewis, Tim Gatman, Jeff Baker, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Tony Nam, Thomas Penny, Jonathan Watkins, Kate Torrey, Kate Foster, Elliot Dash, Ken Jackson, Sonny Lasky, and Jason Stiles. Deathlands number 38, Mars Arena. It was the moon, hanging against the sable sky, as white as a man's skull carved clean, that gave the raiders away. Even the torn, snow-laden clouds didn't soften the icy light. Ryan Cotter slipped through the shadows of the forest to keep them from knowing he was near. The Steyr rifle, that had seen him out of so many tight spots across Deathlands, was hard and sure in his hands. He held his breath as he watched the raiders break into two groups that walked parallel to each other, up the broken terrain in a staggered line. The one-eyed warrior and his companions were outnumbered, at least 7-1. The light snowfall started to thicken as the wind came out of the north and carried a wolf's bite over the Sierra Nevada along the Pacific Ocean. Ryan had shed his coat to double back on the would-be attackers because the material was too light-colored. On the outside, he was freezing. But on the inside, his survival instinct was burning him up. He was a tall man, a couple inches over 6 feet, broad-shouldered and clean-limbed. His dark curling hair held a frosting of snow. Most women would have called him handsome, if not for the black leather patch that covered his left eye, and the cruel, puckered scar that ran from the corner of his right eye, down his cheek to just above his jawbone. Two point men, at the head of each group of the pincer arms, met and knelt to examine the ground in the light of the full moon. Ryan realized they were seeing the footsteps his group had left in the damp earth underneath the crust of snow. Given the weather conditions, it was hard to pass unnoticed, even as practiced as his people were. Ryan watched steadily as the point man nearer to his position turned to his group and pointed toward the east, where the terrain grew steeper. Ryan moved on, moonlight glinting from the weapon in his hands. He had torn branches off trees and stuck them inside his clothing for camouflage, as well as down the neck of his coat and in the sleeves. Other branches were pinned against his chest and shoulders. Ryan whirled, bringing up the Steyr to cover the lone shadow 20 feet away, nearly shooting his friend, J.B. Dix.
Whoa, it's me.
How many?
I counted 42, then I gave up. No wonder they want weapons if they've got those numbers. Those farmers we talked to after we got here have it right. Ambushing, raiding cold hearts.
Someone's definitely in charge. I think we have another gang leader trying to move up the food chain on our hands. I don't like this shit blowing up only a few days' travel from Dean's school. I wonder if it has something to do with the nightmares Christie's been having about him these last weeks.
And old Headmaster Brody and his sect team take good care of those kids. And your boy isn't exactly a helpless kid. We'll get to see him, but we need to take care of this first. Bastard cold out here, and I'm not happy about these pricks not being sociable enough to fall for our little trick back at the other camp.
Could be they did. Maybe they waited until the campfire we left died a bit, then crept down to where we left those rocks piled up in our blankets and realized we'd already gone.
Didn't have any trouble picking up our trail.
JB took off his steel-rimmed glasses for a moment to clean them. When he put them back into place, he reached up and gave his battered fedora a tug, making sure it was settled into place.
I figure Christie and the others are 100 yards ahead of the pack.
Yeah, it's been long enough.
This bunch of cold hearts have got their noses opened up for the chilling they're expecting to dish out. See them down there in two packs? They aren't going to expect us to come up on them from behind.
We want to introduce ourselves fast or slow?
Slow. They aren't interested in moving quick, and they're getting spread out. If we put a few of them down, it'll only add to the confusion when they start running into their own dead, backtracking us after the wheels come off.
The way this snow is picking up and sticking so quick to what's already here, we could buy a few minutes. By the time they get themselves regrouped, the footsteps going up that mountainside will have disappeared.
Maybe we'll have disappeared right alongside them. I got the left.
JB nodded, then faded into the shadows. Ryan moved off after his chosen set of targets. Cold hearts these may be, but Ryan decided they were shit for tactics and stealth. With the Steyr slung over one shoulder, Ryan slowly slipped the Punga free of the chief. The 18-inch weapon sported a wicked blade that he kept killing sharp. He crept up on the man walking drag on the left tensor movement. Ryan clapped a hand over the raider's mouth and sliced the steel edge across the man's exposed neck. The man shuddered in his grasp as the wound spewed hot blood down the dying man's front. He held the man until only spasmodic quivers were left, then shoved the corpse into a stand of brush. He took the man's coat, glancing over his shoulder to make sure he hadn't been seen. In the moonlight and supported in the brush, the dead man looked as if he were about to commit an ambush. As a final touch, Ryan propped up one of the corpse's arms and leveled the man's weapon in front of him. Both dead eyes remained open, catching the moonlight reflected up from the patches of snow around them. It'd be enough to fool most folks. Moving on, he fell in behind the pincer movement again, pulling on the dead man's coat. One pocket was full of something. Feeling around, he identified small flares by touch. Those could come in handy. The garment was snug across the shoulders, too small to be properly closed. The next two men in line were together, their heads down as they trudged. Ryan held his pace, gazing ahead of the two and spotting the man in front of them. Soon the pair walked into a dip in the terrain, hiding them from view of the rest of the squad. Ryan lunged between his two targets and knocked them off balance. He thrust the Panga through the first raider's throat, the point skidding along the vertebrae for an instant, then plunging through the other side. The raider dropped to his knees, hands seizing the Panga, impaling his throat. The second raider turned, leveling a gun at Ryan's chest, and he found himself looking at a pale-faced young woman. Ryan swung an arm out, chopping at the wrist behind the gun. His arm connected solidly, and the gun went spinning away. As she opened her mouth to shout a warning, Ryan stepped in and punched her in the stomach. He slammed his bigger body into her, sending them both crashing to the ground. Ryan landed on top, keeping his face and eye just out of her reach as he put a hand over her mouth. She tried to sink her teeth into him, so he punched her again. Despite the pain, the girl managed to trigger a spring-loaded sleeve sheath, and a long-bladed throwing knife popped into her hand. Ryan flinched to one side just barely in time, but still felt the stinging kiss of the blade as it slipped inside the borrowed coat and scored the skin over his ribs. Pinning her knife arm with his knee, he grabbed her head in both hands. She kicked under him, trying to dislodge his weight. He rode out her efforts, then twisted her head in his hands. The knife fell from nerveless fingers. Her eyes were already dimming when Ryan released her. He forced himself to his feet and ran a hand inside his coat. His fingers came away dotted with blood, the drops black in the gloom.
What the fuck is going on here?
Ryan whirled to see a man standing at the top of the hill that had cut off the violent business from the rest of the raider attack teams. He raced straight at the raider, his hand grabbing a throwing knife. The startled raider raised his rifle when the one-eyed man was less than 15 feet away and closing fast. Ryan drew back his arm and let the knife fly. The knife sailed like a steel dart, barely passing above the muzzle of the leveled rifle. Ryan dove to one side as soon as the knife left his fingers. He hit the ground on his wounded side, rolled at once, clawing the P226 from its holster. Coming up on his knees, the Sig Sauer before him, Ryan watched as the raider staggered, the haft of the knife jutting from between his lips. Ryan kept the Sig Sauer trained on his adversary as he approached. The man fell to his knees, dropping the gun, as Ryan grabbed the haft of the blade and twisted. Ryan yanked his knife free and cleaned the blade on the man's clothes. Glancing down, he noticed a case strapped to the dead man's back. Ryan pulled it off and opened it. Inside, neatly stored, was a fiberglass bow in three pieces that screwed together, and a quiver of arrows. Ryan drew out one of the shafts and studied the big triangular hunting arrowhead at its end. It showed signs of use, like the bow, but appeared in good shape. He put it back, closed the case, and set it to one side before maneuvering the dead man into the trees. It took only a few minutes more to retrieve and clean the panga and to arrange the other two bodies. Ryan hefted the case containing the bow and arrows and resumed his deadly pursuit. Christy Roth put the thought of the pursuing raiders as far out of her mind as she could, concentrating instead on the broken, stony ground of the path she walked along the cliffside, hugging the chilly stone wall. Mildred Wyeth walked beside her, glancing down into the dark valley below.
No torches, no muzzle flashes. That's the good news. The bad news is that Ryan and JB could already be dead, and we just don't know it yet.
No. If Ryan were dead, I'd know.
Pressing on, the red-haired beauty followed the narrow path that Jack had taken only minutes ago. The ledge was only a couple feet wide, and wisps of snow trying to cover its surface made walking a little tricky. Christy felt her deep crimson beauty hair coil tightly against her scalp. She was a couple inches short of 6 feet, with generous curves and emerald green eyes. Navigating another area of loose rock, she concentrated for a moment, trying to feel her lover's presence.
Oh!
Mildred slipped, but righted herself and pressed against the stone face of the mountain. Her coat whipped around her.
Damn, wind! Caught me by surprise.
Of medium height, Mildred was stocky. Her face was almost covered by the hood she wore, but a few of the beaded plaits of her hair hung out on either side of her chin. A checkmade ZKR 551 38 caliber target revolver was in one of her gloved hands. Doc Tanner smiled at her.
Usually, I rather enjoy a brisk walk in cool weather, and mayhap a little adventure as well. However, as we come to the end of this injurious little excursion, I should be vexed to end up without a cup of tea to cap off a rather hectic evening.
Doc, as long as you're flapping your lips the way you are, I know you aren't too put out.
My dear Dr. Wyeth, your erudition is beyond reproach. However, the skill you exhibit in expressing yourself can be a tad bit lacking for one of the medical calling.
Doc was tall and thin, which gave his long arms and legs even greater reach. His silver hair normally fell to his shoulders, but was now whipped into a frenzy by the wind. He thrust his ebony walking stick through his belt, the silver lion's head handle protruding through the part in his coat. The collar of his stained and faded frock coat was visible above the collar of the thermal jacket he wore over it.
Blow it out your ass, Doc.
Christy ignored the bantering. Camaraderie took many forms. Some were more noisy than others. The ledge turned right at nearly 90 degrees. She took it gingerly, keeping her weight toward the stone face. The snow flurry swirled into her face now, making it hard to see. She blinked stinging tears from her eyes. Her hands felt numb, and she had to wonder how much longer she could trust them.
Are you sure about the pass, Doc?
My dear Christy, my certitude is based wholly on the fact that I trust John Barrymore's skills with that mini-sextant of his, even though we're operating on knowledge gleaned from an exercise in cartography that is 100 or so years old and therefore incapable of conforming to a vastly violated topography in this region.
You're making my head hurt.
Simplicity it is, then. You have my best guess. Admittedly, we appear to be betwixt a rock and a hard place.
Christy carefully continued on, but the ledge ended abruptly. Without pause, it vanished right into the side of what looked like a sheer rise of 15 feet or more. She scoured the wall in front of her and on the right. Nothing was there.
What's wrong?
Dead end.
She looked over the ledge to her left, feeling the pull of vertigo. The flying snow vanished into the shadows that lay stretched against the mountainside. She couldn't see the bottom.
What about Jack?
I don't see him. And I can't feel him anywhere near.
Whew. Awful damn slippery here.
Doc came up beside them, one hand on the mountain behind, as he balanced and peered over the edge.
Oh dear, the poor lad.
Ah!
Catching the lower limbs of an oak tree, Ryan pulled himself up into the concealing branches. They shook, littering the ground with snow. Despite the wintry feel of the night and the snow, it was only early fall. Ryan knew for a fact that farther north the land had turned to frozen ruin, and the volcanoes stretched in between, with some of them way to the south. With the volcanoes spouting rad-blasted waste into the air on a regular basis, anything could come falling out of the sky, and he wouldn't have been surprised. He stopped really smelling the sulfur stink hours ago. He nestled in among the boughs, gauging the strength of the raiders spread out around him with a trained eye. His and JB's efforts hadn't gone unrewarded. The steady advance of the raiders had been broken, and a couple dozen milled around waiting for the rearguard to catch up. Word was evidently spreading up the line that a number of them weren't coming. Ryan could see that even the point men were holding their position some 120 yards away at the foothills that led to the steep mountain trail where Christy and the others had gone. Clouds scudded over the bright moon, laying patches of darkness over the broken land. But against the growing white islands of drifting snow, the raiders were easy targets. Ryan opened the case containing the bow and quiver of arrows. The three sections easily screwed into one another. Fitting the string was tricky while standing in the tree, but he managed. The arrows felt heavy enough. Ryan was more at home with a handgun or the panga, which was an old friend, but he knew his way around a bow. His father, Baron Titus Cotter, had seen to the education of all his sons. Ryan knocked an arrow, threw it back to his ear, and sighted through the opening between the branches. Finding a target, he let the arrow fly. Less than 40 yards distant, the arrow pierced a man's inner thigh. The man stumbled, bent double over the fletched end of the arrow. The other raiders stopped and whipped around, looking around for their attacker. Fire blast. Ryan sighted on another target, then released the three-fingered hold he had on the string. This time, the feathered missile flew true, biting deeply into the chest of a raider trying to find cover behind a lightning-blasted tree. The man fell backward into the snow, hands wrapping around the shaft protruding from his chest. The other raiders leveled their guns in Ryan's general direction. None of the bullets came close to Ryan. He drew back another arrow and released it at a figure sprinting across an open space. The shaft went low, taking the man in the thigh. He fell headlong to the ground. Bullets whacked into the oak tree, ripping leaves and branches free as more of the Koldarts spotted the source of the arrows. Ryan abandoned the bow, letting it drop through the branches below, and reached down to grab the barrel of the Steyr. Slipping the sling from his shoulder, he brought the rifle on target as three men broke cover and streaked for the tree. Three corpses dropped in a tangled sprawl before the last one could break away. Ryan emptied the Steyr's clip, bringing down three more men scattered beneath the trees, and one of them for sure wouldn't be getting back up again. A bullet cut through Ryan's sleeve as he worked his way into a clear area between the branches on the rear side of the tree. He stepped out over the 10-foot drop and let go. Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed the shadow along the bole of the tree that didn't fit. It was man-shaped and held a gun. Hayden Lamarck, head secman for Baron Sparning Hardco, a tall, lean man with fair hair, mutton-chop whiskers, and a hawksbill of a nose jutting over a thin-lipped mouth, gazed through his starlight binoculars at the one-eyed man in the oak tree calmly fitting another arrow to the bowstring. Lamarck's second-in-command, Wallace Thorogood, stood at his side.
The fucker's really put his foot up the ass of Satan, Wallace. I'll give you 5-2 that he comes out of it alive.
I'll take your jack. Be man enough to stand you a beer at Dripping Sal's when we get back to Jakestown, sir.
Wallace Thorogood was a blocky man, crowding 60 if he was a day. Dressed in a coat and insulated coveralls, only the man's round face showed, the features resembling those of a demented cherub.
Someone keep those damn horses still. You don't, we could still end up hip-deep in goddamn raiders.
Yes, sir.
The raiders had attacked some of the outer farms around the little ville of Angel Tears less than a week earlier. Representatives from the ville had sailed north to Jakestownville, the biggest community in the seven villes under the control of the five barons, and talked with Baron Hardco himself. Hardco had made it Lamarck's job to track down the raiders and punish them, and assigned 20 men to go with him. Angel Tears was the smallest of the seven villes. As such, it was the least productive and the least developed. Any of the other four barons would have ignored it and let the people in Angel's Tears work out their own problems. Hardco cherished every bit of his temporary empire, even if he had to relinquish it to one of the other barons at the end of the big game in 8 days. Tracking the raiders and putting them down was a nasty job, and it took away from Lamarck helping his baron find champions to fight for his right to rule the Seven Vills for another year. There wasn't anything Lamarck wouldn't do for the man. He knew Hardcore was concerned about losing the Seven Vills to one of the other barons through the baronial charter, and Lamarck had been up late nights thinking about how to ensure Hardcore retained control. But watching the One-Eyed Man work his team ahead of the raiders and double back on them, Lamarck felt a flare of hope. The Raiders' leader was cunning and smart, but the One-Eyed Man was a thriller on wheels, the kind of man Hardco could use for the big game. He'd like to give the Baron some good news when he joined his segment on the ride to Vegas. Still, the Raiders outnumbered the two men they were stalking. Just in case he had to tip the scales in the One-Eyed Man's favor, Lamarck reached for his rifle and kept a keen eye on the advancing enemy. Jack Lauren moved instinctively, rolling through the snow to his left, dodging the creature that swooped past in a blur of white. Eyes moving over the rugged terrain, Jack tried to figure out what had attacked him. All he had noticed was the explosion of movement from the snowbank ahead of him. Jack opened his long coat for access to the .357 Magnum Colt Python at his belt and a pair of his leaf-bladed throwing knives. The creature shot up from the ground as if fired from the mouth of a gun. Diamond-shaped and at least a foot and a half across from opposing corners, the beast sailed through the air straight at Jack's face. The teenager ducked and spun, bringing up the .357. From the brief glimpse he'd caught of the creature, Jack knew it was white and had two deep aquamarine eyes set close together. A thin, barbed tail almost 4 feet long trailed out behind it. When it hit the snow, the beast vanished, blending in like a chameleon. At first, Jack had figured the creature was albino, but the way it vanished into the landscape let him know it had control, at least to some degree, over its coloration. Albinos he knew about. He himself was bone white and had ruby red eyes. His long hair was the color of fresh milk. At something short of 5.5 feet tall and built whipcord lean, he didn't look like the deadly efficient killer that he was. The creature rocketed at him again. Jack figured that the muty beast scooted along the snow until it built up enough speed to get airborne. And evidently it knew how to best use the winds to its advantage. The tail whipped in readiness as it took to the air, and a large fanged mouth opened on its underside. The beast cut through the air, streaking for Jack's neck, flipping sideways to lose altitude and change direction suddenly so it approached from an arc. This time, instead of dodging, Jack took 3 running steps toward the creature. The tail whipped forward under its flat belly. At the last moment, Jack leapt high into the air. He put out a hand, and his fingertips lightly grazed the slick, oily membrane of the animal's body. The muted beast flapped its sides to change direction, but with the wind against it, there was no way it could turn. Jack flipped himself over the creature, doing a half-twist in the air and facing in the direction of the creature's glide path. No more than 5 feet from his target, he landed on his feet and pulled the trigger. 2 of the hollow points slammed into the creature, ripping it apart. It collapsed to the ground, a bloody mass of meat. The teenager put his knives away, then shook the empty casings from the python and reloaded. He grabbed the thing by the tail and dragged it back toward the cliff and scaled when the path ran out.
Jack! Here!
Christy, Mildred, and Doc gazed up at Jack, worried looks on their cold-pinched faces.
Dear lad, we thought you'd fallen to your demise.
No! If I fall, I'd scream. Let you know not safe.
Of course you would. How foolish of me to think otherwise.
Jack shrugged. More weapons were being used down the mountainside. Jack saw the bright sparks leaping among the trees.
What was the blaster fire?
Jack lifted the dead muty beast, then dropped it onto the ledge among them.
This? If you see one, you better chew quick. Otherwise, they chew you.
How'd you get up there?
Step there. Careful. Skin your knees if you go too sudden-like. Then step there. Get up this far. I'll help pull you up.
Christy went first, managing the climb with difficulty.
Did you find the pass?
Not yet. Maybe out there. Not look everywhere yet.
Christy stood beside him, her pistol in her fist. Her attention shifted back to the forested lands farther down, where she could see the deadly firefly twinkle of muzzle flash in the distance.
Shooting's a good sign. If Ryan and JB dead, nobody to shoot at.
Ryan squeezed the Star's trigger before he had the rifle quite to his shoulder. The bullet caught the raider full in the chest and knocked him back. The man's weapon discharged into the ground more than a yard from Ryan, tearing up a fist-sized clod of snow-frosted earth. Already dying, with blood spitting up over his lips, the raider stubbornly tried to bring his weapon to bear again. Ryan shouldered the Steyr and aimed at the man's head. Before he could squeeze off another round, JB fired his Smith & Wesson M4000 shotgun. A nasty hornet's nest of the Remington Flechettes, belched out by the 12-gauge shotgun, tore into the man's face, shoulders, and chest. The impact bared white breastbone and bounced him against the tree bole. The few Flechettes that had missed the man, embedded in the tree, stuck out like steel spurs. JB stood fast and worked his way through the shotgun's magazine, spitting out death. JB stood fast and worked his way through the shotgun's magazine, spitting out death. The swarms of Flechettes chopped into the raiders and stripped them of their sudden courage.
You about ready to get out of here? There ain't that many left.
I'm done.
You take the lead and I'll close the back door.
Turning, his back to a boulder almost as big as a wag, Ryan glanced at the trees and brush where they'd left the dead raiders. The advancing raiders had gone to ground under his fire and were shooting at the corpses. Bullets hitting the dead raiders caused jerky movements, drawing even more intense fire.
That'll slow them for a minute. Let's get out of here.
The armorer took point, moving in a broad semicircle that would bring them to the foot of the mountains. Alert and ready, Ryan moved after JB. JB dove for cover behind a dead oak.
Fire blast.
Ryan dodged and raced to JB's side, fetching up against the wood. Bullets clipped branches from the trees overhead and slammed into the bark on Ryan's side of the dead oak.
Well, this sucks. There's at least two ahead of us.
Let's cover each other and get past them before the others catch up. On three, then.
On three.
Ryan drew the Sig Sauer with his right hand and held the rifle in his left.
Free!
Ryan pushed himself up and into a run. Spotting two men who shared cover behind a big squared-off rock that came up to their chests, he brought up the Sig Sauer and snap-fired two rounds. Both 9mm hollow points caught the man on the left over the heart and drove him backward. As Ryan spun, bringing the Sig Sauer to bear on the second raider, he saw the other man's head jerk backward. Ryan and JB never broke stride. A second later, they reached the rock. Two dead men lay sprawled. Ryan knelt to examine the second raider who'd been standing there. He kicked the man over onto his back, surprised that there was no exit wound from whatever had hit him. The silvery chill of moonlight bathed the dead man's face. A neat, round bullet hole was centered between his wide, staring eyes. JB eyed the corpse, then flicked his glance toward their back trail, checking for other raiders.
Problem?
He's been chilled, but I didn't chill him.
Could have been an accidental shot, well, with all these rounds flying.
Square between the eyes like that?
Ryan shook his head, then raked his gaze over the ridges surrounding the forested valley. The distance was too great and the darkness too deep to allow him to see much.
I don't think so.
JB leaned over and put his fingers on the dead man's face.
Big round, 30-06 maybe. And for it not to penetrate the head means it had to have been a subsonic round.
JB flinched from stone splinters driven from the rock by a fresh salvo of bullets.
Hanging around here is about run its course.
Ryan nodded, his mind still working on the man who lay before him. He didn't care for mysteries or puzzles.
Let's go.
Anything?
Ryan shook his head, scanning their back trail along the climb while they took a breather.
Raiders are coming up behind us, but they're losing ground. You'd think they'd break off after somebody bought it. They're vengeful bastards.
How many?
10, maybe.
Kneeling beside him, JB lifted his fedora and brushed an arm along his forehead. He grimaced at the sweat stains on his coat sleeve.
We keep moving like this. Sweating this hard, we're due for a bad case of hypothermia.
He pushed himself to his feet.
Yeah, let's go.
The cloud cover had wiped away the moon, dimmed the light they had to move by. If it wasn't for the reflective quality of the snow, they wouldn't have been able to see in the dark at all.
The ones who don't fall and kill themselves on the climb, or we don't shoot if they come up on us, a storm may take. Let's catch up to our people before then.
Ryan kept a hand in contact with the stone wall at his side as he pressed forward. The snow flurries increased, burning cold into his face, except where the scar tissue had robbed him of sensation. Without warning, his boots skidded out from under him.
Oh, shit!
The edge of the abyss to his left yawned open suddenly.
Watch it!
JB grabbed him around the waist until he had his balance back.
Got it.
We can rest.
We can rest when we're dead. Something's here.
Ryan scraped at the ground with his boot. Thin black liquid covered the stone in odd-shaped frozen clots.
Blood?
Yeah, somebody's. But I see Jack's marked the wall. Keep going this way, but there's something on the path up ahead.
The shadow turned out to be a dead beast that had been blown apart by bullets. The eyes had dimmed, but there was no mistaking the deadly way the tail was barbed.
You ever seen anything like this?
No.
Ryan slung the creature out over the abyss and let go. He never heard it hit bottom.
Step careful around the blood. I'll help you up first.
Ryan put the stair against the wall and made a stirrup of his hands. Jamie stepped into Ryan's hands and scrambled up as he was pushed along. He reconned the top, then gave Ryan a thumbs up.
Ace on the line. We're clear. Give me your hand, I'll pull you up.
Ryan took the hand JB extended and climbed up. At the top of the wall, Ryan looked back down on the frozen puddle of blood slowly turning white from the snow. It was barely noticeable under the cover of shadows.
That'll be a nice surprise for the first raider or two who happen upon it.
He found Jack's next mark, then turned his steps in that direction. Christy and the others couldn't be much farther ahead. Christy's eyes searched the path ahead of her, looking for solid footing in the snow, with Doc walking behind her. They were up in the crown of the mountains now, and the crevasses that had resulted from the quakes and the volcanic pressures cropped up more frequently. Jack and Mildred had gone off in a northerly direction to check out another route open to them. She still had 15 minutes before they were supposed to return to report their findings. The valley between the gap-toothed peaks she was using as her compass points suddenly split into two again. She turned up the collar of her coat. The thought of Ryan out there unprotected against the elements didn't sit well.
Gaia, watch over him.
What's that, my dear?
Wishful thinking.
The old man came up beside her, his head pulled down into his coat and his hands jammed into his pockets. He held his walking stick up under his arm. The butt of his lama stuck out from between the buttons of the coat.
Ah, this dead of midnight is the noon of thought, and wisdom mounts her zenith with the stars.
Christy rolled her eyes at the comment and considered the two options before her. Both chasms led through the rock, angling down.
Pardon, dear lady. I know your mind is not entertained a whit by my self-indulgent observations.
Not your fault, Doc. I'm just worried about Ryan.
Think not upon that. He'll be along in short order, I'm sure.
I know. I'm just worried about us getting trapped up here.
We've options open to us yet that remain unexplored.
Doc gestured at the narrow defile, standing dark and empty before them.
So, which trail?
Neither of them appear to be heavily trod thoroughfares, but the one on the right beckons, as it appears rather bleaker and even more deserted.
Christy nodded and pulled out her weapon.
Let's get it done. Double red, Doc. We haven't run into any more of those flying things Jack turned up, but that doesn't mean they're not around.
Sally forth, brave lass, and know that I stand at the ready in your service.
Christy headed forward. She kept the .38's hammer eared back, and her eyes shifting back and forth to pick up any movement with her peripheral vision. The mountain quivered unexpectedly, like an old dog staving off its death throes one more night. But it was enough to knock Christy and Doc from their feet.
By the three Kennedys!
Christy covered her head with her arms. Rocks rained all around her, some of them thudding painfully into her body. As quickly as they came, the tremor stopped. Christy raised her head, tasting blood inside her mouth from a split lip. Dust hovered in the air around them, dirtying the snow and mixing with the flurries. She was grateful to find that she hadn't lost her pistol in the confusion. She glanced at her companion.
Doc!
I'm quite all right, my dear Christy. I was just lying here, gathering my thoughts, and making sure I remained yet anatomically correct. I do feel of a piece, but not the piece that I was. And I seem to hurt every place near and dear to me, and a few that I'd not been aware of. I shall choose to view that as a good sign.
Christy took his hand and arm and helped him to his feet.
Thank you for your concern, but I assure you I'm well enough to stand on my own.
Fastidious as ever, Doc took a moment to brush at his clothing while Christy looked around at the debris. She discovered that a fissure in the ground only 2 yards away, which had been only a crack, was now 3 feet across. Some loose rocks skidded down into the hole. Intrigued, Christy crept closer, going down on her belly at the edge of the fissure. She peered down into it, but could see nothing.
Did you hear that?
Indeed I did.
Doc went prone at her side, then stretched out a hand.
Do you feel it?
Christy stretched her hand out over the fissure, careful not to put it too close in case something predatory came roaring up with snapping fangs. The breeze coming up from the fissure wrapped itself around her fingers.
Warm air.
Exactly.
Doc peered down into the gloom, sticking his head in a little farther.
Mayhap the shivers we felt but moments ago opened up a new artery into the heart of the volcanic region beneath this mountain range. Ah, and it's enough to warm an old man's bones.
His movements sent a fresh pile of rock and dirt cascading into the fissure.
Something else is down there. Volcanoes don't make bonging sounds.
No, they don't.
Christy pulled out one of the short torches she carried in her pack. Holding it only a little way inside the fissure, she set it on fire with a self-light match. The oil caught slowly but spread fast, casting golden streamers of incandescence above and below. The fissure hollowed out nearly 3 feet beneath the surface. The shattered stone understructure of the mountain held a chamber that showed signs of old growth. Twisted, dead trees and bushes gathered against low spots where the rainwater runoff evidently flowed through into even lower recesses. The warm air that pushed up into Christie's face smelled of stringent sulfur and bacteria-laden loam. Her hair relaxed around her head, fanning out a little to better absorb the extra heat. She used her gift, trying to sort out any threats that lurked below. From the looks of things, she judged that nothing under the rocky crust lived.
In past times, mayhap even stretching back as far as the nuke cost, that area below was once the top of this mountain.
Christy moved the torch, about ready to give up on the search.
Wait, what's that?
Christy moved the torch again. The chamber was almost 20 feet across and 30 feet deep, with a steep grade leading from the opening to the floor. Flaming bits of the torch dropped the intervening distance, and some of them landed on a metal surface halfway buried in the mountainside. Canted on its side, a crusted over, dirty, blue and white fuselage of a derelict helicopter. The rear propeller was missing, as was much of the tail section, and the main rotor held one bent blade stretching up. The others were buried somewhere under it. The fractured plexiglass bubble was almost covered. The facet of the craft that most interested Christy was the word rescue lettered on the door. She looked around the fissure opening and thought she might be able to make the climb.
I'm going in.
I don't wish to offend you, my dear Christy, but the idea of you in that cave harbors no good thoughts in this weary old head.
She handed him the torch and shrugged out of her backpack.
Good thoughts or not, that was evidently some kind of rescue airwag. There could be medicines and dressings inside that we can use.
Then I beg of you, let me go there in your stead.
Doc, I'm in better shape than you for this sort of thing. If anything happens down there, I'll need you up here.
As you wish. I am yours but to command.
Christy clambered into the fissure, her nasal passages and throat burning as she fought the gag reflex against the sulfur smell. Bracing herself against a wall at a stable rock edge, she fashioned a mask over her nose and mouth from a handkerchief, then took the torch from Doc and slowly stepped from rock to rock, sliding a little on her butt and catching herself with her feet to keep from falling. The craggy wall seemed to pulse in on her with jagged teeth as the torchlight ebbed and flowed. Reaching the bottom of the incline, she rose to her feet and stepped cautiously closer to the helicopter. Resting her hand on the craft, gingerly, Christy peered around it and noticed another fissure under the forward section. The blackness extended a long way. She shoved the torch farther into it, but still couldn't see the bottom.
Are you all right?
Just eyeballing things before I go any farther.
Still moving slowly, she went to the front of the helicopter and peered inside. A skeleton that had gone gray-white in death sat strapped into the pilot seat, dressed in a red short-sleeved shirt and gray slacks. The material hung in shreds, worried at by insects and beasts, faded and ravaged by time. Layers of dust and dirt caked the dead man and the inside of the helicopter. Christy's hair tightened against her neck. She stepped to the side where the door had been torn off. The helicopter had a low ceiling, which didn't give her enough room to stand. But it held seats for the dead man and one other, as well as space behind for cargo. She pulled herself in through the door, pausing a moment, but nothing happened. Evidently, the helicopter was wedged firmly. She held the torch as high as she could and went into the cargo area. A stretcher clung to one wall, halfway covering a red fire extinguisher. Shallow metal racks covered the other wall, filled with narrow drawers. She opened the drawers in succession and smiled when she saw the med supplies that she'd hoped to find. Working quickly, she grabbed up as many of the medical supplies as she could, filling every pouch and pocket she had. Once she got back with the others, they could arrange another raiding party. She took up the torch from the fire extinguisher mounting and started to head back toward the cockpit.
Whoa!
The rumble and shift of the earth made Christy stagger against the wall of the airwag. A blast of malodorous gas made her eyes sting and her head spin. Her mutie ability kicked in with force as she gripped one of the hanging racks, losing her sense of the now. Her senses swam, taking her into fumes. It felt as though her heart had stilled. Christy's sight narrowed, as if drawn into a tunnel, eclipsing her surroundings. A magnetic force with unbelievable power pulled her inside. All the weeks of waking up from nightmares about Dean came back to her in a rush. The urgency to reach him asserted itself, until suddenly, Dean was in there with her. She felt him as the shadows gathered around her, and she could almost see through them. Images changed and darted about, hinting at shapes or things she was familiar with.
Dean? Dean!
Mother Sonia had mentioned experiences similar to the one she was having now. She'd seen trouble coming at times and been able to warn the family members whom she saw in her visions. But Mother Sonia had also said all her visions pertained to those who were related to her by blood. Dean was Ryan's child, not Christie's, born to another woman. Maybe that was why the vision was so unclear. That it existed at all was testimony to her love for Ryan. Suddenly, clarity came to the vision. She stood alone in a room that looked like a concrete bunker, but felt like something else. Broken conduit pipes ran across the low ceiling overhead. Tables lay overturned in the center of the room, playing cards and multicolored discs spilling from them and littering the floor. Corpses littered the room as well. Some hung over the chairs and tables, and others lay across the cards and discs. Many of them were years dead and missing parts from greedy insects and animals, but at least two of them still glistened with their own fresh blood. All of them had died violently. A shadow lurched against the wall to her left. Christy turned, her hand dropping automatically for the butt of her .38, but somehow she wasn't able to reach it. In her frustration, she started to lose the vision.
Concentrate. You don't need a weapon here. You are not here. Find the boy. He must know what you have to say.
Who are you?
Do not waste this time. They will die if you do.
Going forward, Christy stared hard at the shadow. Strangely colored lights caressed the high points of the young man's face and the armor that he wore. In the darkness, she believed the armor was a full-length bulletproof vest that covered the young man from his shoulders to his crotch. Blood trickled from the corner of his mouth, and he kept his handgun pointed toward the door. The barrel wavered, taking all his flagging strength, attempting to hold it level. Even in the darkness, she could tell that he was blonde and light-eyed. It wasn't Dean. Christy felt relief wash over her.
Wait.
Watching the young man, Christy saw the pattern of the colored lights change, winking and shifting to track across the dark skin. A shadow suddenly filled the doorway behind the young man, leaner, but with a dangerous air of self-assurance. The young man whirled to face the doorway. The shadow jumped out of the way as the bullet smacked into the doorframe.
Shit, Lewis! Put that blaster down before you hurt somebody you're not supposed to!
Christy recognized Dean at once. She opened her mouth to call out to him as he crossed the room to the wounded boy.
Save your strength. You'll get your chance to speak with him if you work with me. And you'll have to speak with him if you're going to save his life or that of your mate.
Who are you?
Using her gift, Christy tried to find the source of the voice. Abruptly, Dean started to fade away.
Concentrate.
Christy returned her attention to Dean. The boy looked at Lewis, then pulled at the straps holding the body armor. Blood smeared Dean's fingers as he worked. Reluctantly, the body armor separated. Dean peered under the armor, his face wrinkling in fear and anger.
Oh, shitters! They shot you bad, Lewis. They shot you real bad.
Without saying a word, the taller boy suddenly slumped forward. His face went slack as crimson-stained spittle threaded from his mouth. Dean went down under Lewis's weight.
Lewis! You can't die! You can't leave me here alone! Lewis!
Dean's head snapped up at the sound of the massive beast that he couldn't see. He heaved himself from under the dead boy. Blood, old and new, stained his green-armored vest. He leveled his Browning high power before him, his back against the wall.
Talk to him.
He can't hear me.
Now he can. Your mind will know the words.
Christy stepped forward and reached out to touch Dean, who still gave no indication that he saw her. Her hand passed right through his shoulder, but for an instant, there was the sensation of an electrical discharge.
Dean.
Dean's head swiveled in her direction, and he made an effort to focus.
Christy?
Your father is coming for you. Look for him.
Come. There is still much to do.
And Christy's mind was overwhelmed by the darkness. She opened her eyes and found herself in another hallway that seemed to be in the same building. It also stank of death. Ahead of her, Ryan, clad in a scarlet armored vest, moved through shifting shadows and a cloud of dust. Her lover carried the Steyr rifle in his hands. The knuckles of his left hand were skinned. Blood trickled between his fingers, spattering the floor beneath his steps. His beard growth looked days old, and his eyes had dark hollows under them.
Ryan!
As with Dean, though, the big man didn't hear her. Before she could move to one side of the hallway or the other, he walked right through her. She turned and followed.
Where's Ryan?
It's not time for you to know.
This isn't happening now?
No.
When?
Concentrate! If you lose him, then I lose him. And it could be that you'll lose him for all time. Do you want that?
No.
Christy focused on Ryan, abruptly noticing that his form had grown indistinct.
Follow him!
Christy started forward, surprised at how hard it was to move now. His long stride outdistanced hers. She put more effort into her steps, wishing she could run.
You grow tired. It's not your fault. This is very demanding, especially for you, the focus point.
Ryan hesitated at the next door. It gave Christy almost enough time to catch him. He walked up a short flight of stairs. At the top, a small doorway led into a room that held splintered shards of the same multicolored light Christy had seen during her visit with Dean.
Close enough. Get ready to talk to him.
Christy moved closer as Ryan stepped into the room. A lumpy shadow tore itself free of the ceiling only a few feet in front of him, then came hurtling down. She tried to cry out a warning, but couldn't. Ryan moved fast. Ducking under the lumpy pile of multi-legged flesh, he brought the Steyr's butt around in a wicked arc. The creature scuttled away, hiding under the dilapidated bed. A broken mirror across from it held dozens of images. Ryan drew the Sig Sauer and pumped three rounds into the bed, searching for the mutated creature. Suddenly, it shot out from under the bed, its legs clawing for Ryan.
Fire blast!
He pushed the gun into the creature's face and pulled the trigger. Momentum kept the muted beast flying at him, even after he'd killed it. Blood and ripped pieces of flesh thudded against him. Some of it stuck to the armored vest. The main portion of the creature's corpse dropped in a twisted heap at his boots.
No!
Ryan!
He turned toward her, raising the gun automatically until it centered on her face. His knuckle was whitening on the trigger before he squinted. Then his eye widened in startled recognition.
Christy! I thought they chilled you.
He reached a hand out to her, but it passed through.
I'm not really here, lover. Dean's here with you. Find him.
Dean?
She tried to reach back for him, even though her fingers would surely have passed through his anyway. Almost, they touched. Her eyelids closed.
You've done well. Now it is up to them. Up to the chain of events you've helped set into motion. Destiny is written in the stars. But sometimes we can nudge them a bit in one direction or the other. Hopefully this will be enough.
Enough for what? Why did I say those things to them? That's not what I wanted to say.
Christy tried to open her eyes, but couldn't.
Enough to let both father and son live. You must look to your own needs, my child. Your path remains rocky yet, as well. Take care, and do not tell Ryan. No matter how much you might wish to.
When she opened her eyes, Christy discovered that she was still in the helicopter, leaning heavily against the empty co-pilot seat. All she wanted to do was sleep. She didn't care where. Somehow she had managed to hang on to the torch, which was dying down rapidly now. Smoke filled the interior of the aircraft, stinging her eyes and making her throat burn.
Christy?
She pushed herself up, trying to find a more comfortable place on her shoulders for her bulging pack. She stepped outside the helicopter, walked forward a few yards, and waved the torch.
I'm here, Doc!
So you are, my dear, so you are. I was on the verge of becoming greatly concerned when I saw your torch stop moving about. I thought perhaps you were having some kind of problem and had been incapacitated by something. Believe me, an overactive imagination is a curse of considerable magnitude.
What about the others?
They have not as yet joined us. Perhaps they ran into Ryan and John Barrymore and are even now plotting our course for these dire straits.
At first, Christy thought it might be her imagination. Maybe her stomach jumping around because she was so done in. When pebbles started skittering and falling down the incline, bouncing all over her in their rush to fall into the fissure behind her, she knew it wasn't.
Time for me to get out of...
The earth beneath her feet shuddered, bringing Christy to her knees. The fissure under the helicopter widened, devouring the dirt and rocks upon which she had been standing. Christy scrabbled desperately in the liquefying earth and managed to catch hold of a solid edge of what was now an enormous hole under the helicopter. Her feet kicked over empty air as she tried to find purchase to haul herself up. Suddenly, the helicopter slipped in the grip of the rock and began inching right toward her. Dean Cotter was on an adventure. It wasn't a grand adventure like the ones they talked about or read from books in his literature class. There was no Roland here, no Beowulf, no Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn. But it was an adventure anyway. Calgary Ventnor, a preacher's son with a head like a cabbage and an unfortunate habit of sucking his teeth, and Dean's erstwhile tutor in all things academic, had him in a minor sort of bind. In exchange for help on his tests, he'd agreed to help Calgary achieve his heart's desire, to see if the beautiful Phaedra Lemon actually slept naked, like everyone said. Calgary waved at him from the brush up ahead.
Dean, come on!
The boy moved carefully, picking his way till he reached Calgary.
Did you see anybody?
No!
The Nicholas Brody School hunkered on the gentle swell of land coming up from acres of vegetable gardens. Beyond the cultivated lands, the forest began again. The school had its beginnings in an old stone farmhouse. Rooms and additions had been constructed with concrete blocks, then matted over with adobe bricks. Rifle slits were cut in along the walls, with thick steel shutters that could be pulled closed and bolted down inside. Dean pondered the SecMen's routines and how to best infiltrate the girls' dorm.
It's 2:15 in the morning! If we don't hurry, we're gonna miss seeing it.
If we hurry too much, we're gonna get caught. And then where will we be?
Kicked out, that's for sure.
Phaedra Lemon.
You keep talking like that, and the headmaster's night set crew are going to catch us for certain.
Is.
What?
Is. The night set crew is going to catch us.
You really think so?
Calgary started to stand up. At that moment, the guard they'd been timing came around that side on the catwalk behind the wooden palisades. Dean tackled Calgary and dumped him to the ground, sliding a hand over his mouth.
Shh! Be still or I'm gonna bop you one, I mean it.
Calgary stopped struggling and stared hard at Dean. Dean let him go once the guard had moved on.
What the hell did you do that for?
You were going to give us away.
You're the one who said we were going to get caught.
Jeez, Cal, just keep your head down and follow me.
Wait, I've changed my mind.
What? I don't believe this. It's all you talked about for a fucking week.
I don't think it's a good idea.
Fine, suit yourself. Now that I'm out here, I think I'm going to go have a peek. I'll be double damned for a muty stoop if I've made this trip all for nothing.
You just want to look at her.
Cal, look. You have some choices here. You can stay out here tonight and sleep on the cold, wet ground and slip back into the school when the gardening shift comes out. Or you can join me in climbing those walls with this rope, sneak by Phaedra Lemon's room long enough to find out if those stories are true, and then get the rest of the night's sleep in your own warm bed. Now what's it going to be?
Calgary sucked on his teeth and glanced up at the timber wall. Ryan and JB found Jack and Mildred just after the teenager had pulled a dead man from the collapsed overhang of snow and rock. Mildred lowered her pistol when she recognized them. Keeping the stire in one numbed hand, Ryan wrapped his arms around himself in an attempt to hold in his escaping body heat.
How'd you happen on him?
I didn't chill him. Just found him. Arm sticking out. Saw it.
The man wore a long coat, high boots, and a thermal cap, so furry that the dead eyes under the bill looked like a taxidermist's glassy marbles. A backpack remained strapped on his shoulders. Ryan guessed that the man was probably in his late 50s and had been in robust health, judging from the broad shoulders and leaned-out build. A cottony pallor had set up under his skin, washing it of most of the pigmentation. Jack squatted next to the deceased. He pulled down the man's collar and exhibited the bruised throat, then twisted the head from side to side.
Fresh, Dad. Broke his neck.
Ryan knelt, hopeful that the coat might fit him. Jack stripped off the pack, and Ryan stripped off the coat. He noticed the curious tattoo on the inside of the man's left forearm, near the inner elbow. A big dark blue dot was in the middle, echoed by concentric rings in lighter blue that got bigger and bigger around it, like the ripples made from a stone dropped into a pool. A double strand of orange bars and lines ran through it. Chilled to the bone, Ryan shrugged into the coat, which cut some of the wind.
Did you find the pass?
No. The ridge Jack and I were following petered out into a drop-off that we'd need climbing gear to get down.
Where's Christy and Doc?
We split up. Tom may be a better chance going two directions. Ain't hide from them, though.
Are they supposed to meet you anywhere?
Back along the way you and JB probably came. If they were there, you'd have seen them or they'd have seen you.
Mildred stood close to JB, one of her gloved hands in his. Though they were somewhat reticent about showing their relationship because of their respective taciturn natures, the commitment between them was deep.
When?
Overdue. 8 minutes.
Jack unzipped the backpack and pulled out a largish bundle of foil-colored material. He turned it over in his hands, inspecting it.
What do you have, Jack?
Time tent. Good for heat, good for cold. Got snap to get a pose. Got selfies, ring pulls, and maps in here, too.
The man prepared for some hard living. Take the food, water, and the tent. Let's see the maps.
There wasn't much, but it added to the small stores they had. Ryan unfolded the map carefully because it was old. Long strips of plaster tape held it together and repaired tears in different areas. Purple marker, looking almost black in the thin light reflected by the snow, stained the map, tracing routes across California, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Ryan passed the map to the armorer.
Can't tell if he was coming or going. Mildred, take a look at the tattoo on the inside of this guy's arm. Tell me what you think.
Mildred hunkered down beside the dead man while JB studied the map and Jack dug around in the pack.
The dot, I figure, is the sun. The concentric rings around it are the solar system. The corkscrewed ladder, I don't know. Seen it on some doors in a few of the redoubts we've been inside.
I think it's supposed to be a representation of DNA. But why it would be overlapping the solar system like this so intentionally, I have no idea.
Ryan picked up one of the corpse's limp hands, cold as the stone around it, and felt the fingers and palm.
He didn't do much honest work. Hands are too soft, no calluses. A big man like him, he'd be showing something of his life in his hands if he did anything physical. You have to wonder what brought him out here.
I'm guessing, but I think this guy came down from Montana. This place on the map here is marked with one asterisk. There's a plotted line that leads down to it.
That map is well drawn. Whoever did it took the time to make it neat. But the coastline's wrong. We know that from our trip up.
Yeah, but it's bastard old. Maybe when it was first drawn, it was more accurate. Things could have changed along the Western Islands. Hell, they're changing now.
Light suddenly flared in Jack's hands, bright white, and concentrated in a narrow beam.
Flashlight.
Let me borrow it. Here, look.
Ryan stood up to look, joined by Mildred and Jack. JB traced the purple line north with his forefinger. The line ended at a point lettered Heimdall Point in the lower southwest quadrant of Montana.
This is where he must have started out.
I've never heard of Heimdall Point.
Norse mythology mentions a guy named Heimdall. Guarded a bridge made of fire and water and air and colored like a rainbow. The bridge stretched from Asgard to other parts of the world. Asgard was the home of the Norse gods. Way the story's told, Heimdall had gold teeth and ears so sharp they could hear grass growing.
Sick man to the gods.
Pretty much sums it up. Heimdall carried a trumpet and blew it every time the gods came or went. The stories also mention that Heimdall was supposed to blow that horn the loudest to announce the end of the world, a time they called Ragnarok.
The end of the world's come and gone, unless these people got something more planned. I know something we don't.
A DNA strand overlapping a picture of the solar system. That doesn't sound like they're preparing for the end, or even believe in it.
However it was, his story died with this man.
Yeah, there's probably still people out here who were with him.
Does he have a weapon?
He did. Holster is empty. Maybe lost in the snow when the tremors come.
No long blaster? Somebody shot one of the raiders, and it wasn't JB or me.
Maybe lost that, too.
JB tapped an area beyond the pass they were looking for. It was south and east of Carson City.
There's a pair of asterisks here. I'm betting this guy was headed there next.
Does it say what's there?
This notation's new. Marked on top of a piece of tape, so nothing's lost underneath. It says, Shostakovich's Anvil. Sounds Russian. Could be some kind of Russian settlement there, come drifting down out of the north.
And these people found out about it, and were going to visit?
Way past asking.
Yeah, but it's an ace on the line this man wasn't out here on his own. Come on, let's go find Christy and Doc. We're gonna need shelter soon.